Hebrews chapter 11, and last week we were studying one of the other examples, the third of the examples, specific examples of faith that he gives to us here in this chapter, the third of that, what he refers to when he starts the next chapter, referring back to all that he's describing and giving to us as examples here in this 11th chapter of Hebrews, this great cloud of witnesses. And so the first of those that he gave to us was Abel, and then Enoch, and then in verse 7, Noah. And so we've seen three of these, three of the men that are part of this great cloud of witnesses that encourage us so that we can look to Jesus and then run our race as a Christian with patience and go on to perfection. In verse 8, he gives us our fourth one that he gives us specifically by name. And this one, being the chapter that it is, focused on examples of faith and obedient faith, as we know God is using his definition and description of what a saving faith is, which is what the very term that he used in the last verse of chapter 10, right before he started this chapter, as we are to be of those who believe to the saving of the soul. So not just believing, but believing to the saving of the soul, which right there tells us there's more than one kind of believing. There's a kind of believing that could be fall short of saving the soul, and then there's the believing to the saving of the soul. And that's the kind that we have to have, and that's the kind that he's teaching us about here in Hebrews 11. That's the kind that Abel had. That's the kind of faith that Enoch had. That's the kind of faith that Noah had. But on the subject of faith, and a faith that will be one to the saving of the soul, how are we going to not have a lot brought out and taught about Abraham? Because Abraham is known and referred to by God as the father of those who have faith. It should be no surprise to us that we're going to have more. There are going to be more verses in Hebrews 11 that are about Abraham. Well, also, he's going to mention Sarai, and he's going to mention, he's also going to mention Isaac and Jacob. But when he's teaching us about that family, I mean, there's going to be more verses about that one family than any of the other specific examples in Hebrews chapter 11. That takes nothing away from those other examples, but it just underscores or reminds us of how important the example of Abraham is. We're going to have, he's going to talk about Abraham himself in verses 8 through 10. He's going to be including him in some of the other the things that he states in verses after that. But then he's going to go back specifically to Abraham again in verses 17 through 19. So we're going to have six verses in here that are exclusively about Abraham himself. But let's look at the first three verses about Abraham in Hebrews 11, that is verses 8 through 10. Brother Caleb, can you read that, please?
By faith Abraham, when he was called to go out into the place which he should after receive for an inheritance, obeyed, and he went out, and not knowing whether he went. By faith he sojourned in the land of promise, as he in a strange country, dwelling in the tabernacles with Isaac and Jacob, that heirs with him of the same promises. For he looked for a city which had foundation, whose builder and maker is God. Through faith, also Sarah herself received strength and seed, and was delivered of a child when she was past age, because she judged him faithful who had promised. Therefore sprang there even of one, and him as good as dead. So many as the stars of the sky in multitude, and as the sand which is by the seashore, innumerable.
All right, so verse 8 is where he's now starting to teach us about Abraham's example of faith. And obviously, this is not the only place in God's Word where He teaches us about Abraham, even including the book of Genesis, where we have the original material about Abraham. But we have so many other places in God's Word, especially in the New Testament, where Abraham is given to us as an example. In John chapter 8, so many people are familiar with the words that are in John 8 verse 32, even if they have, and in most cases I believe it is very safe to say that they would have no idea that those words they're familiar with came from the Gospel of John, came from John chapter 8, and specifically John 8, 32, or even from the Bible itself. I don't know how many people even recognize that those words originate in the Bible, but how many people have not heard the words, "The truth will make you free"? I mean, that's very commonly known. But that comes from John 8:32. Now, it doesn't come in John 8:32 in the context that so many people will apply when they use those words, not knowing where they came from. But even a lot of people who do know where they came from misapply it or take it out of context. In John chapter 8, let's read verses 31 and 32 to start with here. He's going to end up teaching about Abraham. So let's read the first two verses there. Brother Ted, John chapter 8, verses 31 and 32. So the statement of verse 32 is built upon what he was teaching in verse 31. Who is the target audience for these words that he's speaking here, according to verse 31? Then said Jesus to whom? To those Jews which believed on him. He's speaking those words to them. Does that say that of the number of the people that were there on this occasion, that it was composed or comprised only of Jews who believed on him? That's going to be very obvious in the reply or response that comes, that there are, Jesus is speaking to a number of Jews, and there are of that number of Jews there on this occasion, believers in him. But there are also among that number those who are not believers in him. He's targeting these words in verses 31 and 32 to those Jews which believed on him. And he says, if ye continue in my word, then are you my disciples indeed. Well, how could that apply to the ones who didn't believe on him? Well, first of all, you can't continue in what you haven't even started. So to continue in his word, you have to start in his word, which means you have to believe in him and in his word. So those are words for his disciples. If you continue in my word, then are you my disciples indeed. So he's speaking to those who are his disciples and teaching how to be his true disciples. And it's not just by becoming a disciple to begin with, which obviously we must do, but to be his disciples indeed. We can't just start. We have to continue in his word. He says, and you shall know the truth. If we continue in his word, we're going to know the truth, because his word is that truth. And that truth, he says, will make us free. Well, then the response to that is going to come from ones, very obviously, who are not believers in him. And they are completely misunderstanding what he's saying. Let's read verses 33 down through verse 33 through 40, Brother Dave.
They answered him, "We be Abraham's seed, and were never in bondage to any man. How sayest thou, you shall be made free?" Jesus answered them, "Verily, verily, I say unto you, whosoever committeth sin is the servant of sin. Servant abideth
So verse 33, they answered him. Now would this be the same ones who believed on him? Well, they said, we be Abraham's seed and we're never in bondage to any man. Well, any disciple of the Lord is not going to tell that kind of a lie. We were never in bondage to any man. Well, what's their situation now? They're under the rulership of the Romans right now. That's why in John chapter, two chapters before in John 6, what were they doing? They were trying to force Jesus to be a king after he fed the miraculous feeding of the 5,000. They tried to take him by force to make him a king. What kind of king? I mean, he's the one that refused that and got away from them and hid himself. He was not going to be an earthly king, which is what they were trying to make him when they were looking for this Messiah, these people, and wanted a king. They wanted an earthly king, and they wanted him to do what? They were looking for somebody that was going to lead them back to political prominence as a nation and to overthrow the Romans, where they're not paying taxes to them or anybody else. What kind of statement is this? And we were never in bondage to any man. They ever heard of Babylon? I mean, this is foolishness. That's an obviously inaccurate statement, whether past or present, from the standpoint of those ones speaking it. But he says, how sayest thou, you shall be made free? What are they thinking about? Physical bondage. And so Jesus, of course, goes on to teach that's not the kind of freedom that he was promising. So look at the context here. To be his disciple indeed, we have to continue in his word. And by continuing in his word, we're going to know his truth, which is revealed in his word. And that truth will make us free. In what way in this context? Well, what is bondage? Not physical bondage or political bondage. But he says, whosoever committed sin is the servant of sin, is the slave of sin. The Greek word doulos for slave. If we commit, whosoever commits sin is the slave of sin. Well, what if I commit sin? Then I'm the slave of sin. That's what Jesus states here. It's a blanket statement. Well, to not be a slave of sin, we have to be set free from that bondage because we all have sinned. Well, then being set free from that, if committing sin makes one to be a slave of sin, then when you are set free from that bondage by his truth, then what are you no longer doing? You're no longer committing that sin. So it's not that you're living the same, but he once credited you as being in bondage to sin, but now even though you're still sinning because you've said some magic words about believing in Jesus, that now you can still commit the same sins, but no longer be regarded by the Lord as being a slave of sin. That's not how it works. Not with God. That's one of the devil's lies. But what the Lord is teaching is, if we're committing sin, we're the slave of sin, but he has given his truth to set us free from that. So we'll no longer do that. Now, in context, what's the difference between what he's teaching us here in John 8 versus the whole purpose and point of Hebrews 11? Because when he gives us all those examples, that great cloud of witnesses in Hebrews 11, then he gets to Hebrews 12 and begins that chapter with the point of it. We have that great cloud of witnesses so that we can lay aside every weight and the sin which does so easily beset us and then run with patience the race that's set before us. So tell me, what's different in the context of the point of Hebrews 11 and this in John 8? It's the same. Well, and Abraham comes up in both cases. Well, it so happens they're the one that bring Abraham up here. As he said, if the Son they'll make you free, you'll be free indeed. That is from sin. Well, they still don't understand, of course, these ones who don't believe in him. Because they brought up Abraham in verse 33 when they said, we be Abraham's seed. Well, what does that mean, Abraham's seed? They are physically descended from Abraham. Their ancestry began with Abraham. At this point, did they still have all the records? Yes. I mean, they still had priesthood. They had, and that was required. I mean, they had the records for their tribes, their families. They could trace their descent from Abraham. So is Jesus challenging, is he questioning their heritage, so to speak? No, he's not. He says, I know that you're Abraham's seed in verse 37. He's acknowledging that. I know physically you are descended from Abraham. Well, what did John the Baptist say when they came to him to be baptized of him? Many of the same ilk. And he said, don't say to me that we're from Abraham. He says, God is able of these stones to raise up. What's there to brag about to be a physical descendant of Abraham with the Lord? That's not, what's that?
They seem to be trying to impute his righteousness and faithfulness onto themselves, which is silly.
It is silly, and it's not working, and not with the Lord. And so he points that out. I know you're Abraham's seed, he says, but you seek to kill me because my word has no place in you. Now that makes it very clear that he's not talking to those of the number there who believed in him, because he told them to continue in his word. Now he's telling that this is the other part of the audience that don't believe in him, and he says his word has no place in them. And he says, I speak that which I've seen with my father, and he says, you do that which you have seen with your father. So he is now, he's making a distinction between these two things here. Seed and children. Seed here, this is physical. I know that you're Abraham's seed. I know physically you've descended from Abraham. But now he says, you do the works of your father. Well, their answer there, verse 39, Abraham is our father. So they're claiming to be children of Abraham, not just Abraham's seed. Well, Jesus is speaking here about what is spiritual. Being a seed, being of the seed of Abraham, does that make one of the children of Abraham? No. Jesus is very clear on that. He said, if you were Abraham's children, you would do the works of Abraham. So when we are children of God, whose children are we also spiritually? According to what Jesus is teaching there by principle, we are also Abraham's children. When we are doing the Lord's work, and think of what he's saying about Abraham to make that statement. To be children of God, we're also children of Abraham. We can't be children of God and not be children of Abraham, because we have to have faith. That's what we're studying in Hebrews 11. Without faith, it's impossible to please God. Well, Abraham had such a faith that he's referred to, and we'll get to it, Lord willing, in a minute here in Romans 4, where he is called the father of those who have faith. So again, anyone who has faith is, by that definition, a child of Abraham. But what kind of faith? A living faith. So here Jesus is talking about the works that we do. So Abraham is the father of those who have faith. Here he's the father of those who do his works. Is there a difference? No, because his faith had those works, which is the point of James 2. A faith without works is dead. And he gave two specific examples there. And who were they? Rahab and Abraham. So over and over again this comes up. But Abraham is an example of having faith in God and showing that faith by works of obedience. And so they weren't doing the works of Abraham. He says, you seek to kill me, a man that has told you the truth, which I've heard of God. This did not Abraham. Certainly not. Abraham would not be seeking to kill someone who spoke God's truth. But so again in verse 41, he says, you do the deeds of your father. So they weren't doing the works of Abraham, therefore they weren't the children of Abraham. Well, then they challenged that and said they weren't born of fornication. We have one father, even God. But then Jesus said in verse 42, if God were your father, you would love me. And then he said in verse 44, he says, you're of your father, the devil. They were doing the works of the devil, so that's whose children they were. If they were Abraham's children, they'd be doing the works of Abraham. But to do the works of God, we have to do the works of Abraham. To be a child of God, it will make us a child of Abraham. So we can see with that. be spiritual children of God and of Abraham, we have to have a faith that works, that obeys. So he's making that point very clear there in John chapter 8. As we mentioned in the book of Romans, we see that again. Let's turn over to Romans chapter 4 now. This is building on, I wish we had time where we could go all the way back to chapter 1, but it's just building chapter after chapter to where he's going here and bringing up Abraham here now in Romans chapter 4, but just to briefly review or summarize what came right before this. I mean, in Romans chapter 1, when he begins the book and teaching them that what they need to know so that they can have an obedient faith, but then what God is, his anger is revealed against those who don't. And then in chapter 2, that we're going to be judged ultimately by our deeds. And then we get to chapter 3, that we have to have faith. Not faith only, but we have to have faith in order to be saved. Well, then in chapter 4, building on that, what example does he give? Well, he's going to give Abraham and David, but chapter 4 is primarily going to be focusing on the example of Abraham. Let's read a portion of this in a little bit further down in Romans chapter 4. I mean, he starts in verse 1 mentioning Abraham. But when he's speaking about Abraham a little bit further down here, about him, he said, let's look at verses 9 through, we'll stop at 17, 9 through 17. Let's see, Brother Tom, can you read that?
Romans 4, 9 through 17.
Yes.
Cometh this blessedness then upon the circumcision only, or upon the uncircumcision also? But we say that faith was reckoned to Abraham for righteousness. How was it then reckoned? When he was in circumcision, or in uncircumcision? Not in circumcision, but in uncircumcision. And he received the sign of circumcision, a seal of the righteousness of the faith, which he had, yet being uncircumcised, that he might be the father of all men that believe, though they be not circumcised, that righteousness might be imputed unto them also. And the father of circumcision to them who are not of circumcision only, but who also walk in the steps of that faith of our father Abraham, which he had being yet uncircumcised, for the promise that he should be the heir of the world was not to Abraham or to his seed through the law, but through the righteousness of faith. For if they which are of the law be heirs, faith is made void, and the promise made of none effect, because the law worketh wrath. For where no law is, there is no transgression. Therefore it is of faith, that it might be by grace to the end, the promise might be sure to all the seed, not to that only which is of the law, but to that also which is of the faith of Abraham, who is the father of us all. As it is written, I have made thee a father of many nations, before him whom he believed, even God, who quickeneth the dead, and called those things which be not as though they were.
All right, so starting in verse 9, he's reminding us that Abraham's blessing was when he was uncircumcised. And so his faith was reckoned to him for righteousness. Now, that goes back to verse 3, where he was quoting from Genesis 15:6, where Abraham believed God and it was imputed, that is, counted unto him as righteousness. So Abraham had faith. He believed what God said, and God counted that righteous, because it was. But when that happened, was that when Abraham was in circumcision or uncircumcision? Uncircumcision. So this is making the point that, going back to the beginning of the chapter, that was Abraham justified by the works of the Old Testament law? No. All of this he's talking about was when he was in circumcision, not circumcision. But of course, that even that which is the token of the covenant itself didn't come until Moses, long after Abraham. So, I mean, it couldn't have been by, Abraham could not have been justified by the faith, by the works of the Old Testament law. That's the point here, building on what he was teaching in chapter 3. So that's what he's pointing out there, starting in verse 9. And then in verse 10, how it was reckoned, his faith was reckoned as righteous when he was in uncircumcision. And but it later, of course, it's Genesis 17 when he received that sign of circumcision, the seal of the righteousness of the faith that he had had when he was uncircumcised, that he might be the father of all them that believe. All. He is the father, the spiritual father of all who believe. He's got to be taught about in Hebrews 11. And, of course, he goes on to say much more about that in those verses that Brother Tom read. We're his children because if we have faith, because he is the father of all those who do believe. So when we're looking at examples of faith and a faith that obey God, how are we going to exceed or do better than Abraham on that subject? So he's bringing that up here. And then it goes down even further that it was not written for his sake alone. This is Romans 4:23, that it was imputed to him, but for us also, to whom it will be imputed if we believe on him that raised up Jesus our Lord from the dead. So the point of all of that is what we see with Abraham's example is for us to follow, so that we will believe and then God will count our faith as righteousness. Now, before he said those words that we just read in verses 23 and 24, he gives the specific example of Abraham's belief in what God said and his promise to give him a son by his wife Sarah. And when he was given that promise, let's go ahead and look at verses 19 through 22. Brother Aaron, Romans 4, 19 through 22.
If being not weak in faith, he considered not his own body, now dead, but he was about 100 years old, even yet the dead was considered in. He staggered not at the promise of God, he was only for his strong faith, giving glory to God. And being fully persuaded that he had promised, he was able also to perform. And therefore, it was imputed to him for righteousness. You say,
yeah, because I already read verses 23 and 24. It was not imputed for his sake alone, or not written that it was imputed for his sake alone, but for us also, because our faith will be imputed by God, counted as righteous if we believe on him, which will make us children of God, but also children of Abraham by that faith. Now, the specific example in Abraham's life that he gives here is when God promised that he was going to give him his son, and he did not. And this is the son through Sarah. So that came in Genesis 17, that particular part. Now, God mentioned that before then. But when he is specifically applying it to Sarah herself, did Abraham's own age or Sarah's age cause Abraham to not believe God's promise? He said, this can't be. I'm too old. She's too old. Can't happen. No, God said it, and therefore, it didn't matter how old he was. If God said that's what was going to happen, that's what was going to happen. So that's the kind of faith he had. As old as he was, and as old as his wife was at the time, long past childbearing age, when God said, I'm going to give you a child and she's going to bear you a son, he believed it. And God counted that as righteous. That's interesting. I mean, that's also in chapter 17, but that's in chapter 15. It's verse 6 where he made that statement that Abraham believed God and he counted it as righteousness. That's not the... How many points in Abraham's life did Abraham believe God and God count that as righteous? I mean, daily. We wouldn't be able to count all those times. The same scripture is used in James 2 about Abraham. We can go over there now to James chapter 2 when he's teaching what a living faith is. And then again, who does he bring up as an example of that? But of course, Abraham. So let's look at verses 20 through 20 through 24. Well, actually, let's do 19. We got it. That one's so good. Verses 19 through 24 here in James chapter 2, Brother Trey.
Now believest that there is one God, thou do as well. The devil also believe and tremble. Wilt thou know, and obey a man, that faith thou works is dead? Did not Abraham our father justified by works being offered Isaac his son upon the altar? Seest thou how faith wrought with his works, and by faith was faith, and by works was faith made perfect? The scripture was fulfilled which said, Abraham believed God, and it was imputed unto him for righteousness, and he was called a friend of God. We see then how that by works of man is justified and not by faith.
All right, so notice again in verse 21, was not Abraham whom? Who? What does he refer to him as? Our father. I mean, this is over and over again. So we're looking at the one. And is there anybody else in Scripture that God gives to us like that and over again tells us anybody who has faith is the child of this one? I mean, he is it for that. So in James 2, well, if we only have faith, but our faith doesn't do anything. I mean, if Abel had just heard God's commandment to make an offering of the first of the flocks, and then he said, okay, I believe you, I should do that, and then didn't do it. I mean, he would be given as an example of faith there in Hebrews 11. And I know we've already, in Enoch, if he just told the Lord he believed him, but didn't actually walk with God, he wouldn't have been mentioned there. And if Abraham, I mean, if Noah had said, yeah, I believe you when you are promising these things that haven't been seen yet, rain, flood, and have commanded me to build an ark, I believe all that, but I'm not doing it. I mean, he wouldn't be an example there. I mean, that would be dead faith. All the examples in Hebrews 11, by faith, they did things. They did things in obedience to God. Their faith had works. Well, if we don't, if our faith doesn't do anything, if all it is something in our minds, then how are we different than the devils in verse 19 in James 2? We're no different at all. Is Satan an atheist? Now, he's created a lot of atheists by convincing people of that lie that there is no God. But he's convincing people of things that he knows better. I mean, he knows there's a God, and all of the devils do. We have lots of... I mean, where did the devil go present himself there in Job? He presented himself before God. And, I mean, how many times did the devils acknowledge who Jesus was? The Holy One of Israel. They know who... They believe in God. They believe Jesus is the Son of God. I mean, that puts them ahead of a lot of people, but that does not make them Christians, and that's not going to save their souls. What makes them devils? They disobey. They disobey. They don't obey God. They don't do it in anything. They believe, but they don't do his will. They won't obey him, so they tremble because they know what's coming. But we're no different than that. If we don't obey the Lord, if we say we believe in him, but we're not doing what he says, I mean, that's what Jesus asked in Luke 6:46. Why call you me Lord, Lord, and do not do things which I say? If we don't, then we're no different than the devils. And we're a vain man, as he says in verse 20, if that's what we're doing. But shouldn't we know that faith without works is dead? So then he goes to Abraham's example and how he was justified by works when he offered Isaac his son upon the altar. How many different points in Abraham's life are brought out as examples of his obedient faith? Well, lots of them. We saw this is not the same one that was used in Romans 4, is it? Romans 4 was when God promised him he was going to have a son by his wife Sarah. And he staggered not in unbelief at God's promise. He didn't consider his own age or the deadness of Sarah's womb. God said Sarah was going to bear a child to him, and he believed it, and it was counted as righteousness. Well, here he quotes Genesis 15:6, that God counted his faith as righteousness, but here it was from what's recorded in Genesis 22, when he offered his son Isaac on the altar. God stopped him before he actually killed his son, but he was in the act in obedience to God. And he's going to bring up that example in Hebrews 11. But the first one he brings up in Hebrews 11 that Brother Caleb read for us a little while ago was what's recorded in Genesis 12, if we can go there. I mean, this is the first real point of Abraham's life that we are told about. We first read about Abraham, or Abram as he was called at the time, back in Genesis chapter 11 and verse 26. So when he's given the genealogy, the descendants of Shem, that starts in verse 10 of Genesis 11. And he traces down until he gets to Nahor in verse 24, that begat Terah. And then Terah was the one who was the father of Abram, Nahor, and Haran. And it tells us in verse 28 of Genesis 11 that Haran died before his father Terah in the land of his nativity in Ur of the Chaldees. And I always loved that when I was over in India, because in Tamil, when you ask where you're from, I mean, that's called what we call our hometown is your Ur. So I used to always like, well, what's Abraham's Ur? It's Ur. I mean, that's the same word in Tamil, so it's kind of funny. Caleb gets it. But that is the same thing, isn't it? So his Ur was Ur. But anyway, he was from Ur of the Chaldees. Haran tells us that he died, and this is Abraham's brother, who was also the father of whom? Lot. And so Abraham took in Lot, his nephew, because Abraham's brother had died. And he looked after Lot for the rest of his days. They started in Ur of the Chaldees. Haran died there. But what happened after that? Abram and his brother Nahor, they took wives. It tells us in verse 30 of Genesis 11 that Sarai was barren. That's Abram's wife. And she had no child. Well, Abram's wife was Sarai, he told us in verse 29. She was barren, had no child. And then Terah took Abram, his son, and Lot, the son of Haran, his son's son, and Sarai, his daughter-in-law, his son Abram's wife. Verse 31 of Genesis 11 says they went forth with him from Ur of the Chaldees, well, to go into the land of Canaan. That's what chapter 12 is going to tell us about. Ultimately, that's where Abraham's going to go. But they first came, they left Ur and went to Haran. Now from there, Abraham is going to go to Canaan, and that's what Genesis 12 tells us about. And that's what is brought up in verses 8 through 10 in Hebrews 11. So let's read from in Genesis chapter 12, verses 1 1 through 5. Genesis 12, verses 1 through 5. Brother Samuel. So here's Abram, as he's known at the time. God speaks to him and tells him to get away from his country and from his kindred, his family, from his father's house, to a land that God was going to show him. So God says, I'm going to take you to this land. He says, I'm going to then make a great nation of you. And all the families of the earth were going to be blessed. He was going to give him the land of Canaan. So those three great promises that he was going to have that be the father of a great nation and that would inherit the land of Canaan. And then all the nations of the earth would be blessed through him. And that, as we know from the New Testament, that was a promise of the sending of his son, Jesus Christ. That was the fulfillment of that part. But he told him, get away from his family, his land, and go to this place God was going to show him that he's never been to before, which is one of the points that was brought out there in Hebrews chapter 11 in verse 8. When he was called to go out into a place which he should after receive for an inheritance, he went out not knowing whither he went. I mean, he didn't know what that destination was. He'd never been there. So here, just considering, of course, he goes on to tell us Abraham in verse 4 that Abram was 75 years old when he left Haran and he went to Canaan. So this is a point when he's 75. But at that age, I mean, he still had his family, but he's told to leave all of his kinfolks, all of his relatives, and leave that place, go to this place that he'd never been to, that he didn't know where he was going, pack up with all of his family and leave. And he did it. Now, I mean, how many people would do that? How many people would just, God says, okay, get up and you leave all your kinfolk. I mean, is he gonna be with them anymore? No. Go someplace you've never been, and then that's where you're gonna be for the rest of your life. I mean, this is not a small thing that he was told to do. But when God said, here's what I'm going to do with you, now go do this, what did he do? He obeyed. By faith, Abraham obeyed God. He believed what God said, and then he did what God commanded him to do. So he's showing a living faith here. And he's trusting in all of these promises of God. Now, we can dig deeper. Why would God tell him to leave his family? Was there a reason why God was trying to separate Abraham and his immediate family from all of the kinfolks, which of course, I mean, Sarai was his half sister. So why was he separating them from their kinfolks? Joshua chapter 24. Verses 1 through 3, if we can read that. Brother Michael, can you read that? Joshua 24, 1 through 3.
Joshua gathered all the tribes of Israel and Shechem and called to it for the elders of Israel, for their heads, and for the judges, and for their officers, and they presented themselves before God. Joshua said unto all the people, thus saith the Lord God of Israel, the fathers dwelt on the other side of the flood in the whole time. Terah, the father of Abraham, and the father of Nahor, and they served other gods. And I took your father Abraham from the other side of the flood and led him throughout the land of Canaan, and multiplied the seed and gave him Isaac.
See, God had a good reason for that commandment that he gave to Abraham. Was it going to be... I mean, God knew that he had a righteous man with Abraham and a very righteous woman, Sarah, his wife. Was it going to be for the spiritual good of that family to be in that environment around all their relatives who were idol worshipers? No. So God wanted to separate them from those idol worshipers of their family. God had a good reason for what he told Abraham to do for the sake of his own family. And now, did Abraham understand all the reasons and the why he had to go here and all of that? No. But when God said, here's what I want you to do, he trusted the Lord and he obeyed him. And that's given as an example to follow. I mean, that, and we all have to do that. We have to follow the same principle, all of us, to be his children. Because being a Christian, well, what's the term for the, what does the word church mean? Ekklesia is the Greek word for church. What is the, ek is out. That's the first part of it. Yeah, kaleo is the other part, which is where our English word call comes from. It's the called out ones. Well, what are we called out of? 1 Peter 2, we're called out of darkness into his marvelous light. 2 Corinthians chapter 6, 14 through 18, we're told to come out from among them and be separate. We're supposed to come out from the world. We have to come out of this world. We cannot be a part of the world. We're in it, but we can't be of it and be a child of God. In Abraham's case, he had to physically, God commanded him physically to remove himself from those people, but What had to be in Abraham's mind to do that is what has to be in all of our minds to be a child of Abraham and a child of God. What was in Abraham's mind? I mean, what did he point out there in verse 10 of Hebrews 11? Why was he willing to do it? Why did he say, "Well, I love my dad and I love my brother and I love all my cousins and all these, you know, that, I mean, you think he did? Sure he did. But was he of them? Was he the same as them? No, he believed in God. He was not going to worship idols like his family. But what does it tell us in Hebrews 11 and verse 10? Well, verse 9, I mean, when he was called to go out into a place which he should have to receive for an inheritance, obey. So there's that word in verse 8. By faith, Abraham obeyed. That's the kind of faith that he's teaching us about here. And he went out not knowing whether he went. By faith, he sojourned in a land of promise, as in a strange country, dwelling in tabernacles with Isaac and Jacob, the heirs with him of the same promise. I mean, did he have a permanent place there in Canaan? No. I mean, he dwelt in tents. I mean, he moved around through that land a lot, but they had not yet been given that land. That was to be given to his children much later. But he and his son Isaac and his grandson Jacob, they did that. Course, the women also. And what was the basis of that in verse 10?
Looking for a home that had foundations built by God.
Yeah. So did he come out from this world? Was this world, we sing the song, I know that Brother Glenn leads it a lot, "This world is not my home." I mean, was it their home? Abraham did not consider this world his home. So when God said for him to leave some place in this world to go some other place where God wanted him to be, that's where he went. And God had a good reason for him to be there. And it was, of course, for his spiritual good. But what God told him to do, that he did. He obeyed the Lord out of his faith. And it was based in the fact that he was looking for a city which has foundations, whose builder and maker is God. He was looking... He was concerned about his eternal home, where he was going to spend his eternity, and he wanted to spend that with his Creator, with God. And so he was going to serve God and do whatever God told him to do in this life. And that was Abraham's life. That's why, to be children of God, we have to be children of Abraham. But we all have to make that decision that we're going to come out from the world. And wherever we are in this world, though we're in it, we can't be of it. I mean, we live in Columbia, but are we of Columbia? I mean, we better not be. We're here, but we better not be of it. Do we consider this? Here's a question. If we could just stay here, somehow we could have the opportunity, we could just live here in Columbia for eternity, and that we would never have to die, but we'd never have to leave here, versus one day we'd go to heaven and be with God, which would we rather do? Well, if there's any hesitation or flinching in our minds about that, we got a big problem, because that says that we're really kind of getting like Lot's wife. She really liked Sodom and Gomorrah. She was sorry to leave it. We're going to leave here. We are all going to leave here one day, and it's not going to be that long, certainly from the standpoint of eternity, for even the youngest of our number in here. We're not going to be here that long. We're all leaving. We're going to go to eternity. Do we love this world, or are we looking for a city that's builder and maker is God, that we want to be with our Creator where He is forever? And are we then willing to do whatever He wants us to do and commands us to do in this life, whatever that requires, wherever that leads us? You remember that one in Luke 9, that one that said, I will follow you whithersoever thou goest. And then Jesus pointed out how the foxes, they have holes in them, and the animals have their places. They have a dwelling place, but the Son of Man has not where to lay his head, he said. So he was pointing out what that means. We do have to follow him wherever he will go, but that's not an easy life. Are we willing to give it all up? Are we willing to forsake everything? Whatever it takes. If we're not, we can't be his disciple. That's Luke 14:33. But we have to be willing to go wherever he wants us to go, whatever it is, whatever the circumstance requires in our life, at any day, at any point. If this is what our decision to serve the Lord is going to require this, we should always be willing to do whatever that is for the Lord's sake, and not say, well, I'm not willing to do that because there's some part of me that loves this world. There wasn't that in Abraham. That's why he gives that example to start with. There's a lot more. We're out of time for tonight, but we'll continue with that. The example of Abraham, he's already brought up Isaac and Jacob. He's going to bring up Sarah. He's going to have more to say about all of them in the coming verses. And Lord willing, we'll look some more at that next week.